this morning, Transport Workers Local Union versus the International Union. Silver.
Excuse the walking. I have two new knees.
Oh. Good.
I hope so.
Excuse me. You see me get off the bench and my walk slowly too, but I don't have a new back.
Good morning, Your Honors. In this case, plaintiff's appellant TWU Local Unions 561565 request Court of Appeal to grant their appeal of the District Court denial of the plaintiff appellant's motion for summary judgment to grant injunctive relief against appellant, defendant appellee TWU Local Union International Union action to dissolve plaintiff appellant TWU Local Unions and to reinstate Local Unions 561565 with their constituent membership now merged into a single local union and reinstate their duly elected officers, money, books, and properties. The District Court determined that the TWU International Union will cause TWU Local Unions to suffer irreparable harm. Local Unions TWU 561565 submit the TWU International action to dissolve and revoke the charters of their 561565 and remove their duly elected officers without their consent over the objections of their local unions and their members constitutes an unlawful coup of the unions, local unions, and is an unreasonable action in violation of the express provisions of the TWU International Constitution.
Which express provision is violated by this?
Yes, sir.
The district judge found that there were none.
The district judge found that the International had plenary power. The action to dissolve the TWU local unions is in violation of Article 5, Section 4, Article 6, Section 4, Article 8, Sections 8 and 9, Article 12, the structure, Article 14 of the local unions.
I gather you're not referring me to any specific prohibition.
I will. The difference between...
My suggestion is you get to it right away.
The Constitution grants the international authorization to abolish the local unions under express specified circumstances. This is what they are. Quote, the international union president shall have reason to believe any local union is failing to comply with any provision of the Constitution or conduct its affairs in a manner detrimental to the interests of the union. Article 5, Section 4. Or local union members have become reduced to the point that in the opinion of the International Executive Council, the NOCO can no longer perform its function. The Constitution also provides that the membership shall function through local unions established on a geographic basis, members within a city or geographic area established or specified by the International Executive Council. 10 or more members shall constitute a local union. The district court found...
Mr. Silber, let me just be very clear. I look at those provisions that provide some specific authority for the international union. I don't see any provision that says that's the only power that the international union has over the locals. And this kind of constitutional problem comes up often. We've got it in the United States Constitution. Can Congress establish a Federal Reserve Bank? Well, the Constitution doesn't actually say so. It grants a lot of other specific powers, but not that one. In essence, why is it unreasonable to read this ambiguous document as allowing other actions by the international union?
Your Honor, I don't think that this is an ambiguous document. The document must have a reason that it's very, very specific as to the reasons that a local union can be dissolved. And the district court found that this action by the international union did not come within that authority or within their powers. The Constitution, again, is very, very specific as to the establishment of local unions. What we have here is the abolishment of five local unions for reasons that doesn't exist. There was absolutely no reason whatsoever to indicate that these local unions did not perform or could not perform. The only reason that was cited by the international union was that American Airlines, which flew me here, is in bankruptcy court, and that the local unions would no longer have one paid officer. So what? Most unions in the United States don't have that. And secondly, the international never, ever indicated that by not having that paid officer, the local unions could not perform or could not function or could not represent the members. And the local union said, we can, we have, and we will, and there's nothing here that indicate that they can't. Our position is that there's no legal doctrine that grants the TWU International Union unlimited, broad, plenary authority to dissolve local unions with such authority not limited by and outside the scope of the express conditions of the Constitution, even when such express condition expressly govern the extent of the IEC to dissolve a local union. What we don't have here is a broad statement saying that the international has the plenary power, but we have the specific provisions under the circumstances and conditions under which the local unions can be dissolved. That's pretty serious stuff. And when the international union, when the local unions had requested to have what was called self-determination elections, there was very specific provisions in the Constitution that permitted that. And so there were self-determination elections, which in turn established these maintenance local unions, and then they continued to represent their membership. Now they're gone. Five local unions will be gone. There is no, quote, local unions. There is now one local union. And the actions by the international union are totally outside the scope of the specific reasons that are given in the Constitution. We wouldn't be here if there was any kind of statement in the Constitution that granted the international plenary power in order to, quote, abolish the local unions. There's no case law on that whatsoever. And then secondly, in terms of then establishing new local unions. We think the case that is, give me a minute, most applicable is the ILA Local 1516 versus ILA Local Unions, which governs the legitimacy of TW Union International Union action to dissolve these local unions. That if an international union's proposed merger and dissolution and dissolvement of a local union falls outside the authority granted to the Executive Council, the union, the Constitution prohibits the merger. And that court said, quote, the ILA correctly argues that its courts are generally bound to accept the union's interpretation of its own constitution. We also held the union's constitution interpretation must be fair and reasonable. Under the ILA constitution, the proposed merger and dissolvement of the local union falls outside the authority granted to the Executive Council. The plain language of the ILA Constitution prohibits its merger and dissolvement. Your Honor, we think that case governs. We don't have simply creation of new local unions, splitting of unions, which has occurred in the past. We don't argue with that. We have the elimination and the abolishment of five local unions for a reason that does not exist.
And that has already happened, right?
Yes, sir.
So why isn't this appeal moot?
I'm sorry, say again.
Why is this appeal not moot, since you didn't ask the district judge to rescind that action and didn't ask us to stay it?
It's not moot. The district court ruled that the decision denying injunctive relief is immediately appealable. Most of the factors for granting injunctive relief weigh in favor of the locals, and the defunct locals could be reconstituted if they were ultimately prevail at trial.
Counsel, I understand theoretically rescission is possible, but when did you ask for that?
I'm sorry, immediately.
When? When did you ask a court to rescind the dissolution of those locals?
We were even told that we didn't exhaust our remedies. We immediately asked for it. Immediately. I don't have a date in front of me. We, on a continuous basis, Your Honor, from October, after October 9th, we were immediately, October 9th, the defendant first notified the local unions. And then from that point on, October 2, the international first notified the locals. October 9th, the local unions, on an ongoing basis, immediately ask you that they cease and desist from this action.
Right.
I'm
asking you about the difference between asking the court to stop something that has not happened yet. Now it's already happened. And asking the courts to unwind the transactions, restore bank accounts, records, etc. One of the things that concerns me here is that back in April, our court issued an order that, in essence, invited you to file a separate motion to expedite the appeal. And as near as I can tell, there was no response.
I think what I filed apparently was deficient, and then immediately we were granted the opportunity to file the briefs, and that's what we did. We just followed immediately that schedule. And then I saw that this hearing date was immediately put on, and that's what I followed. And to me, then, to file for an expedited at this point, I didn't get it. I didn't understand, because it wouldn't have made any sense to me, because all the dates were immediately followed, and they seemed to, you know, to come immediately at that point, and that's what we did.
Counsel, you're going to be into your rebuttal time if you want to say.
Oh, well, I thought, I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Simon.
May it please the Court, Bruce Simon, Cohn, Weiss, and Simon for Pelley Transit Workers Union. This appeal calls to mind three widely accepted principles of federal jurisprudence, one of which, mootness, was just addressed, is jurisdictional. The other two reflect the judiciary's strong disinclination to interfere in purely internal union disputes. First of those other two is that the court will uphold the union's interpretation of its own constitution unless unreasonable, perhaps even patently unreasonable. That's this circuit's holding in Falk. Second, as a corollary, to protect unions from heavy-handed judicial interference, not my phrase, this court's phrase in Sanderson.
We've never been heavy-handed, have we?
Certainly not while I'm standing.
You don't have to answer
certainly
that
not
question.
While I'm standing before you. I will address the jurisdictional issue, mootness, first. As a jurisdictional matter, the appeal seeks a review of denial of injunctive relief where the event sought to be enjoined has already occurred. The Keogh decision in this circuit, cited on page 21 of our brief, and Judge Bauer is familiar with it, cited a host of other circuits already holding that where the event in question occurs, quote, any possible use for a preliminary injunction is expired, and any appeal is moot. And appellants may not circumvent mootness by attempting to reframe their request for relief as a request for rescission of the event. In the TransEuro case cited in our brief at page 24, the Tenth Circuit held that plaintiff, having sought below to enjoin a merger and lost a preliminary injunction, could not reframe its request for divestiture once the merger had occurred. And the appeal from the denial of the injunctive relief against the merger was held moot. While that was a corporate merger, to be sure, the parallel here, I would suggest, is clear. There is no question but that the merger sought to be enjoined is a fact of life. The new local 591 has been chartered. The 591 office have been elected, including four of the offices of the five locals at stake here. It is functioning. It is up and running for 6 months. The plaintiff locals have been dissolved. Their charters have been revoked. The plaintiff locals' monies, books, properties are now the property of the new merged local 591. There is nothing left to be enjoined. Unless the court has questions on mootness, I'll proceed to the other two issues. But I think it's really fairly clear, and as I noted, it is jurisdictional. Let me turn to the denial of the preliminary injunction. This court reviews the denial of a preliminary injunction on the deferential abuse of discretion standard. The traditional standard applied by the district court in ruling on motions for the extraordinary remedy of preliminary injunctive relief is unquestioned. There has to be a clear showing of irreparable harm, likelihood to succeed on the merits. The irreparable harm to plaintiff has to exceed that to defendants, and the public interest is implicated. The district court below relied on the successive merits standard. In both his denial of the temporary restraining order and days later in his denial of a preliminary injunction, the district court concluded that the appellant locals, quote, have not established even a minimal likelihood of success on the merits. And 2 days later, the locals cannot meet their burden of showing even a negligible likelihood of success. The court below placed very heavy reliance on the standard judicial intention not to involve themselves in the purely internal disputes of a union structure. It also relied heavily upon the court's deference to the determination of a constitutional interpretation by the person or body appropriately designated in the Constitution to make those decisions. In this case, the TWU proceeded through a six-month process of investigation, of financial analysis, of consultation with officers of the local unions, including among those the officers of the plaintiff unions here, of a subcommittee report, of a International Executive Council review of that report, of a presidential interpretation of the constitutional provisions involved, and concluded, the IEC concluded, that for the purpose of permitting the employees of American to be more fully represented in a more economical basis, that they should be represented by a single consolidated local union. The president issued...
Counsel, you may have indicated here, but did the number of union mechanics or employees change in any major way after the consolidation?
The consolidation hasn't taken place. And the financial office of the TWU, their economist, predicted that as a consequence of the merger, the closing of bases, the amalgamation of mechanic services between the airlines, that some 2,000 jobs would be lost this year. This year hasn't yet taken place. The fact that the national union with the local unions participated in order to avoid the rendition of a decision under Section 1113 of the Bankruptcy Code, vitiated the Baker letter, which provided a couple of $1 million of payment by American to the local unions to offset the cost of representing them. That was going to impose an additional serious economic burden on the local unions. So between the loss of membership projected by the TWU's expert and the loss of dues incomes resulting from the inevitable so-called synergies, the reduction of the workforce, that the better economic result and the better representational result for the members involved would be the amalgamation into a single union.
Counsel, I understand your arguments on the merits of the decision, but in terms of the constitutional argument, you're making pretty broad claims, of course. Is there anything under your view that the IEC could not do to a local union under the Constitution?
Going back to the ILA decision, they could not do something that was explicitly prohibited by the Constitution.
Is anything explicitly prohibited with respect to union locals?
Your Honor, as I stand here and think of it now, I cannot come up with one. But if there is one, and if the IEC violated, then the court's deference to the internal union process would be erased, and this court and the district court presumably would have viewed the matter differently. But I do not believe there is any explicit prohibition. The whole structure, and it goes back to what happens under the Railway Labor Act. You have a class and craft determination made by the National Mediation Board of what is the unit of employees to be represented. That unit is represented not by the local unions. It is represented only by the TWU, the national union. The TWU negotiates the contract with the employer. It administers the contract with the employer. For its convenience, the international union establishes and uses local unions to assist them in that regard.
Is that different for transport worker unions, either this one in particular or others, as distinct from...
I don't want to speak absolutely. There is a difference under the Railway Labor Act and the National Labor Relations Act as to how the units are determined, and there is a factual difference. Typically, in the Railway Labor Act context, that is either railroads or airlines, you have national unions who are the authorized exclusive collective bargaining representative who then choose to function in some regards using local unions as an aid. Under the National Labor Relations Act, it goes both ways. You have some unions that operate on a national level where the national union is the certified representative by the NLRB, but you have many, 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 many where it's the local unions that are certified.
Say construction or something like that, where you may have very localized.
So you have that, but it's more of a factual difference than one mandated under the law. The Railway Labor Act, you may recall, was established back in 1926, virtually 10 years before the NLRA, and it had developed its own systems, its own culture, so to speak. And that culture was national representation by national unions. The culture that developed under the National Labor Relations Act for employers not covered by the Railway Labor Act was different.
Any physical location with regard to the national compared to headquarters of American?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where American is located as to their headquarters, any relationship to that?
Yes, the American Airlines is located in Dallas, and much of what occurs, certainly in the local union representation, also takes place in Dallas. But by its very nature, American has significant bases all over the country. Mechanics are employed in many of those bases, most of those bases. There is a difference between, the overnight maintenance mechanics work provided in New York and in Miami as compared with the major overhaul bases where the work is performed in two or three major overhaul bases for the major checks, the D checks.
I recall years ago there was some issue about requiring the union employees to move to other locations to accommodate the structure of the union?
Yeah, there's been no issue of that, Your Honor.
And sure, but
no. If the court has no further questions, I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, counsel. How much time?
You okay?
You have 3 minutes.
I have new needs.
Good.
Thank you, Your Honor. Real quickly, back on the issue of mootness, what makes this case different than others is that those local unions that were dissolved are still all members of the Transport Workers Local Union. The dues are still paid in to the TWU. And if, in fact, the injunction would be granted, then it's not too hard to reestablish those same local unions. They're all there. They're not outside the International Union. And then to reconstitute the unions, as the district court said, could be done. And also, in that same regard, when the defendant opposed the our brief and it talked about exhaustion of administrative remedies, it said if they appeal to the TWU convention, they could be provided with full relief, reestablishing their pre-existing locals and restoring them to their pre-consolidation assets, restoring them with their assets. I think that applies. That the mootness, and simply because it's the international and the local unions, simply does not apply here. And the local unions did everything it could before the court and then after the court in terms of trying to get an injunction with respect to what occurred here. With respect to the Railway Labor Act, the National Labor Relations Act, I don't think it matters. What matters is the Constitution. And the Constitution is very clear on the establishment of local unions. There is no question that the international has exclusive representation, but there's a mandate under the Constitution with respect to the local unions. Those local unions, in fact, were established. And they were abolished. The prime reason was for the so-called Baker letter and that the fact that there would not be, that the company would no longer pay for one of their members, a representative, anymore. And the Constitution does provide that the local unions do participate, in fact, in the negotiation, in the negotiation process. Is that the end? I'm sorry, is my time?
No, you can continue. Thank you.
Is it up? Or
no, it's not up.
Okay. In this case, we simply think that the international union was simply, if you will, even unhanded and not even-handed. We wouldn't be here if we weren't looking to the Constitution. And if the Constitution did not provide the specific provisions under which a local union could be dissolved and the international had followed one of those provisions, or the district court did rule they simply did not apply, then we wouldn't be here. But there's nothing in that Constitution, if you will, that grants this international union so-called plenary power now to dissolve the local unions, which it created under the self-determination elections, which in turn were under the Constitution. We believe the Constitution governs and that they should not, the international union, should not be allowed to go outside of the internet, of that Constitution. And we believe further that that Longshoreman case that I cited does govern because the International went outside the provisions of the Constitution in order to dissolve the local union.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. To the